Someone told me of a man who raises thoroughbred racehorses, and one of his favorite words is class. He'll talk about how one horse has class and another one doesn't, and how this class can make the difference in a race. That's a little puzzling to me because it seems like the horse that could run fastest would win, whether it has class or not. So what did he mean by the word class? According to this man, class is calling on reserve energy. Class is the ability to overcome any number of challenges during a race. Class doesn't mean you never get tired, but it does mean you never show it. Class doesn't mean you're not tempted to quit sometimes, but it does mean you never actually do. And in the final yards of a race, class makes the difference. The title of this session is Perseverance, but it could very well have been class, because they seem to be very similar qualities. Whatever word you want to use, this is an extremely important element of strong character. I also suspect that in recent years we've overlooked the importance of perseverance to some extent, because we believe so strongly in talent as the true determinant of success. For instance, there are a great many special programs in the schools for so-called gifted children, and these programs can begin as early as the first grade. A child is tested, and he's either gifted or he isn't. He either has talent or he doesn't. Our expectations of him change based on how he does on those tests, and his expectations for himself change also. Of course, there are some educational systems that place a little less faith in talent and a little more faith in long, hard work. And since those systems have been the source of some incredible progress in recent years, I think it's important to look closely at perseverance and how you can get some of that stuff, whatever your gifts and talents may be. But can you really develop perseverance? After all, that quality is something that's bred into racehorses over many generations. Can the human equivalent of class and perseverance really be learned the way you can learn to drive a car or play a musical instrument? To a great extent, I think perseverance can be learned, and there are some very powerful techniques that can help you learn it. By far, the most important tool you can use in developing perseverance is a personal list of challenging, realistic, well-defined, and highly rewarding goals. Goals are major to a genuinely success-oriented person. Without them, you're just playing around. The difference between a goal-directed individual and someone without goals is like the difference between a Wimbledon champion and a kid batting a tennis ball around on a court with no net, no opponent to bring out the best in him, and no way of keeping score. Despite everything that's been written about the importance of goal setting, very few people actually put it into practice. It's always amazed me the way the average guy puts more thought and effort into planning his 2-week vacation than he devotes to planning his life. What's he taking a vacation from? He hasn't really decided what he's trying to do in life, but for 2 weeks out of the year, he just decides he wants to do something else. And this is what he plans very carefully. Challenge creates strong character, and goals represent challenge in its most positive form. Leaders have their personal goals clearly in focus, as well as the goals of the organization. In fact, one of the principal responsibilities of leadership is defining goals for the vast majority of people who aren't able to do it for themselves. Over the years, I've developed some ideas about effective goal setting, and I'd like to share those with you in a moment. And I also want to point out some traps of goal-directed behavior that aren't usually talked about, but that certainly ought to be. When I was a kid, I used to dream what it would be like to buy a ticket on a railroad train and just go someplace. I really didn't think about where I'd be going or how long it would take to get there. I just love the idea of getting on the train and just letting it take me someplace. I guess there's still something appealing about that idea, but it's not really the way you want to live your life as a mature human being. When you grow up, you buy a ticket on a train or a plane because you want to go someplace, and you know exactly where you're going. You may have to change planes in a different city. Your flight may be canceled, and you may have to switch to another flight. You may not feel like talking to the person seated next to you, but you will persist. You know where you're headed, and you're quite determined to get there. That's goal-directed behavior in its simplest form. There are short-term goals and long-term goals. Sometimes you're flying across the country, other times you're just walking down to the corner grocery store. Long-term goals are the equivalent of a major journey. When you reach the point where you've achieved your long-term goals, your life will be fundamentally changed, and the process of getting to that point will transform you into a stronger, wiser, higher-performing person than you are now. How can you identify your long-term goals? On a sheet of paper or in a notebook, write these five headings. Number one, what do I want to do? Number two, what do I want to be? Number three, what do I want to see? Number four, what do I want to have? And number five, where do I want to go? Now, under each of these categories, write down several possible long-term goals. Be very relaxed about this. Just allow your mind to flow and come up with 3 to 6 ideas for each category. Don't worry about a lot of details at this point, and don't spend too much time describing a particular goal. In category number one, for example, what do I want to do? Suppose you want to write a book about the history of your family, going back to the arrival of your great-grandparents in the United States. Just quickly jot down family history. Then as you look down the list of categories, it occurs to you that you've always wanted to see the pyramids in Egypt. So you write pyramids. Keep writing down ideas as long as the list of categories continues to inspire you. You'll probably be surprised at some of the things that turn up. You may have kept a great many desires and aspirations hidden in the back of your mind, but the opportunity to write them down will move them to the forefront of your consciousness. That's one of the benefits of this technique. When you're satisfied with your list of long-term goals, read through the list once again. Then, beside each item, write the number of years that you believe it will take you to achieve that particular goal. It's best to round off the numbers into 1 year, 3 year, 5 year, 10 year categories. For example, you may estimate that it will take you 10 years to research and write the book on your family history. But you'll need only 5 years to get yourself into a position where you can take a trip to the pyramids. Create a time frame like this for every one of your long-term goals. Immediate goals, those that will take less than a year to achieve, are important too, of course, and we'll deal with those separately in a moment. When you're finished entering your time frames, there should be a fairly balanced distribution of all your goals. If there are many 1 and 3 year objectives, but only a few in the 10 year category, maybe you need to think more about what you really want your life to add up to. What kind of life you really want to build over the long run. But if there's a preponderance of 10 year goals, and relatively few of the shorter term variety, this may be an indication that you're putting things off, that you're focused too much on where you'll be at the end of the day and not enough on what you can accomplish right now. Keep working on your list, adding and subtracting goals with various time frames until you've created a more or less even distribution. Now comes the really challenging and interesting part. So far, you've just been adding things to the list, but now it's time to start making some selections. Now you're going to start asking yourself what's really important compared to what might just be sort of fun. Choose four goals from each of the four time frames, 1 year, 3 year, 5 year, and 10 year. Now you have 16 separate goals. So far, you've only referred to them in shorthand fashion, but now you're going to start seeing them very, very clearly in your mind's eye. You're going to see each goal just as if it were being realized this very minute. And you're going to write down a detailed description of exactly what you see. Do you intend to open a handmade furniture store in 3 years? What will the store look like from the street out front? Will there be gold leaf lettering on the windows? Or will there be a sign hanging over the door instead? How many square feet will the store contain? Will there be a showroom area for the furniture in front and a workspace in back? Or will the furniture be built at a different location? Do you intend to have any employees, or will you run the business entirely by yourself? Think of all the questions that need to be answered in order to see your goal with absolute clarity. And then write the information down in a notebook or on a piece of paper. That will become one of your most important personal possessions. But that's not all. Any goal is a powerful motivator only if there's a powerful reason behind it. Why do you want to achieve your goals? Why do you want to own a handmade furniture store, or a private airplane, or a newspaper in a small town in Vermont? Why do you want to compete in a triathlon, or visit the Australian outback, or be the first woman in your family to earn a PhD? Write down your reasons for wanting each goal in the same degree of detail that you use to write your descriptions. If you can't find a clear and convincing reason for each of your 16 goals, do some serious reevaluating. You may have more whims or pipe dreams than real goals, and now is the time to make that discovery. Keep working on your list until you have 16 clearly envisioned, strongly motivating long-term goals. Review what you've written at times, and keep track of your progress toward these objectives. Above all, persevere. Goal setting is a very important first step, but goal achievement is a continuous, lifelong process. That's what makes it so challenging. That's also why it's so extremely rewarding to finally attain your long-term goals. With regard to immediate goals, those that require anywhere from a day to a year to achieve, I recommend creating lots of objectives that can be accomplished in a month or less. Write them down. Read what you've written at frequent intervals. Keep track of your progress. And do something often that brings you closer to realizing these very short-term objectives. That way, you'll always have something to celebrate. These goals are not only important in their own right, they're also confidence builders and motivators toward a lifestyle based on perseverance and achievement. Let me close this discussion by emphasizing the fundamental importance of goal setting for success, leadership, and creating strong character. Let me also emphasize the fact that perseverance is about as important to goal achievement as gasoline is to driving a car. Sure, there will be times when you feel like you're spinning your wheels, but you'll always get out of the rut with genuine perseverance. Without it, you won't even be able to start your engine. That situation and how to avoid it is what we'll be talking about in a moment. The opposite of perseverance is procrastination. Perseverance means you never quit. Procrastination usually means you never get started. Although I consider the inability to finish something to be a form of procrastination. Ask people why they procrastinate, and you'll often hear something like this: I'm a perfectionist. Everything has to be just right before I can get down to work. No distractions, not too much noise, no telephone calls interrupting me, and of course I have to be feeling well physically too. I can't work when I have a headache. The other end of procrastination, being unable to finish, also has a perfectionist explanation. I'm just never satisfied. I'm my own harshest critic. If all the I's aren't dotted and all the T's aren't crossed, I just can't consider that I'm done. That's just the way I am, and I'll probably never change. Do you see what's going on here? A fault is being turned into a virtue. The perfectionist is saying that his standards are just too high for this world. This fault into virtue syndrome is a common defense when people are called upon to discuss their weaknesses. But in the end, it's just a very pious kind of excuse making. It certainly doesn't have anything to do with what's really behind procrastination. The basis of procrastination could be fear of failure. That's what extreme perfectionism really is, once you take a hard look at it. What's the difference whether you're afraid of being less than perfect or afraid of anything else? You're still paralyzed by fear. What's the difference whether you never start or never finish? You're still stuck. You're still going nowhere. You're still overwhelmed by whatever task is before you. You're still allowing yourself to be dominated by a negative vision of the future in which you see yourself being criticized or laughed at or punished or ridden out of town on a rail. Of course, this negative vision of the future is really a mechanism that allows you to do nothing. It's a very convenient mental tool. Well, I'm going to tell you how to overcome procrastination. I'm going to show you how to turn procrastination into perseverance. And if you do what I suggest, the process will be virtually painless. I'm going to be very specific about how you can do this. A moment ago, I referred to a negative vision of the future as a mental tool for inactivity. If you've been using that tool, I'm going to ask you to toss it aside and start using two other very powerful principles that foster productivity and perseverance instead of passivity and procrastination. The first principle is break it down. No matter what you're trying to accomplish, whether it's writing a book or climbing a mountain or painting a house, the key to achievement is your ability to break down the task into manageable pieces and knock them off one at a time. Focus on accomplishing what's right in front of you at this moment and ignore what's off in the distance someplace. Substitute real-time positive thinking for negative future visualization. That's the first all-important technique for bringing an end to procrastination. Suppose I were to ask you if you could write a 400-page novel. If you're like most people, that would be an impossible task. As soon as I ask you that question, a picture appears in your mind of a big fat book lying on a coffee table, hundreds and hundreds of words covering every page. Yes, somebody must have written the book that you see in your mind's eye, but that person surely wasn't you. But suppose I asked you a different question. Suppose I ask if you can write a page and a quarter a day for 1 year. Do you think you could do it? Now the task is starting to seem more manageable. We're breaking down the 400-page book into bite-sized pieces. But even so, I suspect many people would still find the prospect intimidating. Do you see why? Writing a page and a quarter may not seem so bad, but you're being asked to look ahead one whole year. When people start to look that far ahead, many of them automatically go into a negative mode. So let me formulate the idea of writing a book in yet another way. Let me break it down even more. Suppose I were to ask you, can you fill up a page and a quarter with words not for a year, not for a month, not even for a week, but just today? Don't look any further ahead than that. I believe most people would confidently declare that they could accomplish that. And of course, these would be the same people who feel totally incapable of writing a whole book. Then if I said the same thing to those people tomorrow, if I told them, I don't want you to look back, I don't want you to look ahead, I just want you to fill up a page and a quarter this day. Do you think you can do it? One day at a time. You've probably heard that phrase. That's what we're doing here. We're breaking the time required for a major task down into one-day segments. And we're breaking the work involved in writing a 400-page book down into page and a quarter increments. Keep this up for 1 year, and you'll write the book. Discipline yourself to look neither forward nor backward, and you can accomplish things you never thought you could possibly do. One of the beauties of this technique is the fact that you can really take it to the extremes if you have to. If writing a page and a quarter during 1 day still seems too much for you, break it down even more. Try to write 3 sentences in the next hour. Don't look any further ahead than that. Come up with a way of looking at the task that finally seems manageable. Then all you have to do is persevere. Procrastination won't be a problem, because the task is now so small that fear won't kick in. And it all begins with those 3 words, break it down. My second technique for defeating procrastination is also only 3 words long. The 3 words are, write it down. We've seen how important writing is to goal setting. The writing you'll do for beating procrastination is very similar. But instead of focusing on the future, you're now going to be writing about the present, just as you experience it every day. Instead of describing the things that you want to do or the places you want to go, you're going to describe what you actually do with your time, and you're going to keep a written record of the places you actually go. In other words, you're going to keep a diary of your activities, and you're going to be amazed by the distractions, detours, and downright waste of time that you come up with during the course of a day. All of these get in the way of achieving your goals. For many people, it's almost like they planned it that way, and maybe at some unconscious level, they did. The great thing about keeping a time diary is that it brings all this out in the open. It forces you to see what you're actually doing and what you're not doing. The time diary doesn't have to be anything elaborate. Just buy a little spiral notebook that you can easily carry in your pocket. When you go to lunch, when you drive across town, when you go to the dry cleaners, when you spend some time shooting the breeze at the copy machine, make a quick note of the time you began the activity and the time it ended. Try to make this notation as soon as possible, but if it's inconvenient to do it immediately, you can do it later. But you should make an entry in your time diary at least once every 30 minutes. And you should keep this up for at least a week. What else do you have to do to gain the benefits of this extremely powerful productivity technique? Nothing. You don't have to do anything else at all. It's just a process for making yourself aware of how you actually spend your time. You will naturally and effortlessly begin to reorganize your life. Perhaps that seems like too much to believe, but it's true. When you're forced to write down the fact that you hung out at the coffee machine for 15 minutes today, you'll think twice about doing that again tomorrow. When you've got to put it in writing that you worked on an important project for 30 minutes today and then took a break to read the newspaper, you'll persevere a little longer on the project tomorrow and forget about the newspaper. Just try keeping a time diary for 1 week, and you'll see how it can revolutionize your ability to focus and achieve your goals. Break it down, write it down. Very easy to understand, very straightforward. But these are powerful and effective productivity techniques. This is how you put an end to procrastination. This is how you get yourself started. But how do you keep going? How do you keep your motivation consistently high? How do you learn to persevere when the novelty is worn off and you're still some distance from your goal? We'll talk about that in a moment. The Irish poet William Butler Yeats once wrote a poem describing some of the unfortunate characteristics of the modern world. One of the things Yeats noticed was the fact that bad people seem to have the most energy, while good people become discouraged and doubtful of their own abilities. The best lack all conviction, while the worst are filled with a passionate intensity. Those are the words Yeats used. And it's true that we can look around the world and see all sorts of things happening that we might wish were not happening. And there are people working very hard to make those things happen for reasons that we might not admire. And when we see that, it's easy to start saying, what's the use? What hope do I really have? Why don't I just give up on all the things I've been trying to accomplish and just start taking it easy? Even people of strong character feel that way sometimes. All of us have moments like that. That's when perseverance gets really, really tough. What's the answer? Well, you recall that during our discussion of goal setting, I asked you to list 5 categories for your long-term goals. What do you want to do? What do you want to be? What do you want to see? What do you want to have? Where do you want to go? Now I want you to add another one. With whom do you want to share? In other words, who are you working for besides yourself? In the first 5 categories, you were asked to focus exclusively on your own aspirations and why they were important to you. But now I want you to think in terms of other people. Who is depending on you? Who will benefit if you persevere and succeed? Who will suffer if you give up and stop trying? Who can you reach out to and help once you've achieved your goals? Write down answers to these questions, just like you wrote answers for the other categories. For many people, the answers will appear quite readily. If you have a family, your spouse and your children are depending on you. Perhaps even your parents are depending on you now, if they're elderly and require some care. But even if you're a single person or just starting out in your career, you can think of reasons to persevere and succeed that go beyond your personal needs. Maybe you would like to share some of your financial success with the schools that educated you, or with the religious institutions that gave you spiritual guidance, or with a hospital that helped to heal you on some occasion. This sharing doesn't have to be limited to money either. If your work has given you certain skills, you can share your time and your abilities. You can and you should. But even this isn't putting it strongly enough. It isn't just that you'll do better if you feel you're working for others in addition to yourself. You absolutely must find reasons outside yourself to persevere if you want to keep going when the going gets tough. Hemingway wrote, "A man alone hasn't got a chance." And that doesn't mean only that you need people to help you in life. It means also that you need people you can help. You need people who can become the real reasons for perseverance above and beyond your material possessions or your financial success. What's in it for me can only take you so far. What's in it for somebody besides me can take you as far as you need to go. In the last days of World War II, the American cruiser Indianapolis was sunk by an enemy submarine. This was one of the most tragic incidents of the war for American forces, in which hundreds of men lost their lives. Many who made it through the initial attack had to spend days and nights in the water before rescuers arrived. The experience of trying to stay alive in the water was so overwhelming that many people simply gave up. In fact, the survivors reported later that virtually everyone wanted to give up at one time or another. But whenever someone wanted to quit trying, the others would talk to him about the people back home who needed him, who were depending on him to survive. And if there was no one who was depending on him right then, they would talk about people in the future who would someday be needing him, people he hadn't met yet, people who hadn't even been born yet. They conjured up all sorts of reasons above and beyond simply surviving. This motivation beyond the self was the only motivation that was strong enough. And what was true in an extreme sense for those men in wartime is also true in all our lives, no matter what we're trying to accomplish. We began this discussion with some mention of racehorses and how the best of them can overcome any challenge in a race. I don't know what motivates a racehorse, whether it's a bale of hay just beyond the finish line or the thought of resting in a warm stall, but I doubt there's much thought of what he can do for the other horses. Well, that's one big difference between horses and people. People depend on one another. And people of strong character take pride in what they can do for others. Challenge yourself to become a person like that, and come what may, you will have the strength to persevere. People are born hungry. During the first few moments of life, a human infant is totally consumed by its appetite, first for air, then for nourishment. People stay hungry too. We're hungry all our lives. But exactly what it takes to satisfy our hunger usually changes a great deal. By the time we reach adulthood, some of us are hungry for wealth and power. Some of us are hungry for truth. Some people want everyone to love them. Others want everyone to fear them. But there's a fundamental challenge with all these appetites. None of them can ever be permanently satisfied. When it comes to wanting things, there's never any such thing as enough. And that can really get on our nerves. You get a new car, but in a couple of years, it's an old car. You get a new computer. It does everything real fast, certainly faster than the one your neighbor's got. But then a year goes by, and now your neighbor gets a computer that's even faster than yours. Where does it all end? There's really only one kind of person who's actually comfortable with the impossibility of satisfying his appetites. This is the person who wants that mysterious commodity called wisdom, whatever that is, and wants it more than all the cars and computers in the world. Wisdom, like the learning capacity of the human brain, is infinite. There will always be more to know, and there will always be plenty of room in your brain for everything you learn. Life is a paradise, really, if you're a person who genuinely wants wisdom. We all want to be successful, and I'm certainly in favor of that, but I've known some people who literally wanted all the money they could get. Not what the money could buy, but the money itself. The nickels, the dimes, the quarters. Wanting all the money in the world is like wanting to know all there is to know in the world. Except the man who wants all the money is miserable. He'll never get it all, and he'll never think he has enough. Even if he had rooms filled with $1,000 bills, he'd still want the next man's nickel. And he'd be in pain about that, filled with envy about it. The man who wants wisdom also wants to look back over his shoulder at the other guy, but he just wants to see what the other guy is reading. And if the other guy is reading a book he hasn't read yet, he's actually happy about it. He looks forward to reading it himself. The acquisition of wisdom is not what all the mathematicians call a zero-sum game. You don't have to give up something in order for me to have it. You can give me your wisdom and now I'll have it, but you still have it too. When one person shares wisdom with another, neither person is diminished. In fact, both are made wiser. Giving and taking is such a basic experience for most of us, but the whole concept of giving and taking doesn't really apply to wisdom. There's no giving and taking, there's only sharing. Wisdom is a unique commodity, if indeed it can even be called a commodity. Unlike the other things people hunger for, wisdom is very hard to visualize. We could imagine rooms full of money, but how can you picture a room full of wisdom? Books aren't wisdom. They're just pieces of paper bound together. Books can help create wisdom in people's mind, but if you look inside their heads, you won't find any wisdom there. So what is it, anyway? To most people, wisdom seems like something in a distant country, as if it were on a tropical island somewhere. Few people, if any, have ever seen it, but it's something that everybody's heard reports about. But almost everybody believes wisdom exists, even if they've never seen it. In that sense, wisdom is almost like God, except it isn't a divine quality, it's a human quality, a very rare, very precious human quality. Ask anybody, and they will probably tell you that there is such a thing as wisdom. Furthermore, that person will also tell you that he or she hopes someday to become wise. Ask the same person how to become wise, how to get wisdom, and if that person has some wisdom in him, he probably will just smile or nod or tell you to live and look around you and think about what you see and hear. There was once a man who was a great investment banker, one of the foremost in the world in his profession. He was born in poverty in Europe, was completely self-taught, and had used brains and guts to make a tremendous fortune. Many listened in fascination to this man telling the story of his life, and then would say, "Sir, you should write a book that would sum up all you've learned about the world and about how to succeed in it." But this great international investment banker just looked and smiled. He said, "Well, I suppose I could do that, but it wouldn't really be much of a book. In fact, I could tell you everything I know in just 15 or 20 minutes, everything I've come to understand over the course of a lifetime. But what good would it do? These aren't things you can just hear about from someone else or read in a book. Until you've discovered them for yourself, they're just words, just puffs of air or drops of ink on a page. You've got to live in order to learn what I've learned. You've got to arrive at these truths the way you arrive at your destination after a long journey, with that same sense of fulfillment and joy." It's ironic, isn't it? Wisdom is not a thing you can buy, or a course you can take in school, or a degree you can earn. Yet every parent wants his children to attend good schools, and rightfully so. Wisdom is not really something you can get from another person, yet you can gain some wisdom from everyone you meet. Wisdom is something a wise man always feels he needs more of, yet the true sources of wisdom lie nowhere but within ourselves. There are plenty of people who are too smart for their own good, people who are filled to overflowing with facts and technical knowledge, but who are sadly lacking in human understanding and common sense. We've all met people like that. They score high on all the tests. They get perfect grades in school. They win all the prizes. They often get paid very well to practice their skills, to build things, and write computer programs, and carry on lawsuits, and manage other people's affairs. But go home with one of these whizzes. Look at their lives outside of work, if they have a life outside their work, and you'll find that all sorts of things that regular people know, like the difference between right and wrong, and what's fair, and how to give happiness, and what life is worth, that they haven't even thought about. "What's that got to do with me?" the smart one asks. "What is this thing you call common sense? What is this stuff you call human wisdom? What is this thing you call strong character?" I've seen people who have everything you could possibly want, every object you could dream of, everything you can drive down the street or sail on the ocean or fly through the air. But on the inside, where the real person lives, they're broke. They haven't got anything. They haven't got a clue. The Bible tells us that King Solomon was the wisest man in the whole world, But he was not only the wisest, he was also the richest man in the world. Kings and queens came from all over the world to get Solomon's advice and to admire his riches. In fact, legend has it that Solomon had wives from every nation on earth. And there's no report of any marital disharmony. Not one divorce. Was this a wise man or what? The Bible tells us that when Solomon was just a young man living in the court of King David, his father, God told him he would grant him one wish. You know what he wished for? He didn't wish for a kingdom. He didn't wish for great power. He didn't wish for good looks or unlimited pleasure or long life or love or fame or security. Solomon asked God to grant him wisdom. And because he asked for wisdom and none of the other things, God gave him everything else too. The most important difference between you and me and Solomon isn't where or when we were born, or the privileges we have or don't. The difference isn't in our names or our bank accounts, or the positions we hold in life. The difference is Solomon got wisdom by asking God for it. The rest of us must look around us for wisdom, and look for it in everything we read and in everything we do, and in everyone we meet. And most of all, we must look for it in ourselves, perhaps more than any other element of strong character. Wisdom is a quality that we must earn and learn on our own. Yes, wisdom is a unique component of character. If you don't have it, nobody can tell you what it is. And if you do have it, probably you'll be wise enough never to say, "I'm a wise person." The wisest man in ancient Greece, the greatest philosopher the world has ever known, was a man named Socrates. In fact, Socrates made wisdom his profession. Philosopher means lover of wisdom in ancient Greek. And because he didn't have another job, people were always asking Socrates, "So what do you do for a living?" He was definitely smart enough to figure out that he had to have an answer. So he made up his own job title, philosopher. But when people asked Socrates, "What is wisdom?" he always gave the same answer, "I don't know." In fact, Socrates never claimed to know much of anything, except how to ask questions. And by asking questions, he would prove to other people that they didn't know what they thought they knew or were certain of. Everybody in Greece agreed that Socrates was the wisest man in Greece. But unlike King Solomon, the philosopher Socrates didn't have great wealth. The wisest man in Greece was poor. King Solomon managed to run a huge household with many wives and homes and lots of children, and he accomplished this without any discord or unhappiness. But Socrates had no home life at all. The wisest man in Greece was married to a famous and terrible nag, and they had no children. Socrates, the wisest man in Greece, just went to the marketplace every day and hung around and asked people questions and hoped to get invited to a banquet so he wouldn't have to go home and face his wife. King Solomon was honored by all the great leaders of his time. But Socrates, the wisest man in Greece, didn't even have any support among the powerful people in his own country. Their sons would go to Socrates and learn what they could from the philosopher, but the powerful families of Athens, the Greek city where Socrates lived, got tired of Socrates' questions. They grew exasperated with the way he was teaching the youth of Greece that nobody knows anything for sure. So they accused the wisest man in Greece of corrupting their children. Instead of honoring the greatest philosopher who ever lived, the Athenians sentenced Socrates to death. Unless he would take back what he taught, unless he would apologize. But Socrates didn't take it back. He didn't apologize. Socrates cheerfully drank down a cup of poison and just sat there calmly saying goodbye to his few faithful students, asking questions the whole time. Solomon and Socrates, two very wise men, but two very different destinies. Great wisdom is no guarantee of anything, but to those who really care about it, wisdom is its own reward. Socrates could have avoided prosecution as a criminal if he had just admitted he was wrong. And you could make a case that agreeing to be executed when you could avoid it by just saying a few words is not very wise, perhaps not even smart. And you'd be right if it were you or me in that position, but it was the right thing to do for Socrates, because Socrates really knew who he was, and he knew that what gave his life meaning and made it worth living was just this manner he had of asking questions and trying to answer them honestly. After all, what would the rest of your life be like if you were to suddenly become dishonest to yourself? After dedicating yourself so long to honesty and wisdom, Socrates knew who he was and what his life meant, and he understood that even one bit of lip service in his last moments would undo all the good and meaningful questions he'd been asking for more than 70 years. Is that wisdom, you may ask once again? And again I would answer with a question. Like Socrates, wisdom for whom? For you and I, or for the wisest man in Greece? What might be wisdom for you and I, who possibly could live quite happily, despite knowing that we had compromised our beliefs, would not be wisdom for someone who had totally dedicated himself to seeking the truth? Know thyself, was Socrates' motto. He knew himself well enough to realize that he had to drink that cup of poison, and his character was strong enough so that he was actually able to do it. I know a few people who make their livings as personal financial planners. They help individuals and families define their financial needs today and in the coming years, and they help people do what must be done to provide for those needs. Any good personal financial planner will tell you that most people are insufficiently prepared for retirement. And I would add that this lack of preparedness is not limited to the financial sphere. Because for a mature human being, there has got to be some higher value or higher truth than just staying on in life, just catching a few more gasps of air, or even having a large enough retirement income so you can spend your final years on the golf course. In my work, I've talked a lot about what conclusions you should draw if you're not wealthy by the time you're 50 or 60 years of age, how it's an indication of poor planning or poor self-management. But if you're 50 or 60 and you haven't really thought about what more there is, or who you are, and why you're here, and what your life means, well, you just haven't provided for your old age. Don't worry about a financial planner. You need a personal wisdom consultant. Part of wisdom is knowing what you lack, and looking for it, and asking for it. Another part of wisdom is knowing, at the same time as you ask, that there are no final answers. There are always more questions. There are always more things and people you don't now know and haven't yet heard of or seen. So you may have that retirement package. You may have the medical benefits, the pension, the Sunbelt home, and a steady income you can live on. What good is it if you're isolated? And I don't mean just physically alone. I mean isolated from a real sense of connection with what's come before and with what lies ahead. It's here that wisdom provides very real, very practical benefits. It's wisdom that provides a sense of life's value and assurance that all the effort has been worthwhile. There's no question that we must take care of our material needs, but a fulfilled life requires meaning as well as substance. Wisdom is the fruit of experience. Experience is something everyone gets if they live long enough, but not everyone knows what to do with it. Wisdom comes from seeing the world and the people in it, and from noticing patterns and connections, and from using what other people let you see of themselves in order to understand your own self. I can hear somebody saying, "Wait a minute, you've spent a lot of time saying that nobody knows what wisdom is, and now you're giving a detailed description of it." Well, I'm not saying I know what wisdom is. I'm just saying I know where it comes from. I know what it takes to get it. In fact, I've never met a person who actually said, "I know what wisdom is." About as close as I'll ever come to say that is to say that I know what the opposite of a wise person is. The opposite of a wise person is a fool. And a fool usually gets treated like a fool, sooner or later. There's a story about a man who spends his whole life traveling to the far corners of the earth to seek out some sage or master or yogi who will tell the meaning of life. The seeker crosses the deserts and oceans. He starves and suffers. And finally he's on his last legs with his rags blowing off his back in tatters as he crawls to the mouth of a cave where an old man wearing nothing but a hair shirt and a long gray beard is sitting cross-legged in the snow. "What is the meaning of life?" gasps the seeker of truth. The old yogi suddenly looks very surprised. "What?" he exclaims. "So the meaning of life is what?" I knew a wise man once, a man I'd really come to admire. I wanted very badly to define the essence of his wisdom, to isolate exactly what was the source of his great insight into life. So I finally asked him, "What is it that really makes you different from everyone else?" And he said, "What makes me different is that I can see that we're all the same. Anybody can see the differences between people. Wisdom is understanding how we're really alike." Abraham Lincoln used to say things like that. And in my opinion, he's one of the most admirable individuals in all of history. Lincoln was a man with a very strong sense of right and wrong. He was able to lead this country through the Civil War because he knew that it was just plain wrong for one man to own another as a slave. But he also understood that the man on the other side of the issue, the person across the battle line, was a human being too, with the same hopes and fears and problems as the people on Lincoln's side. Despite all the differences, Lincoln was able to see the essential sameness, the essential oneness. Like Lincoln, Albert Einstein came from humble beginnings, not just financially, but in the way he was looked upon by other people. When he was a young boy, Einstein was thought to be stupid, and he even flunked elementary mathematics. He was always a little distracted, asking questions, but not able to put those questions into words. Even when he grew up and got a job in the Swiss Patent Office, nobody guessed that Einstein was still asking questions that would shape the whole world. After he published his theory of relativity, which laid the foundation of the atomic age, Einstein didn't get a swelled head. He kept asking questions about who we are and why we're here and how the universe is made. Even after he was able to find answers to some of the most profound scientific questions that had ever been put forward, Einstein still remained an essentially humble person, and he never suggested that his answers were the final ones. Why should they be? After all, everything in the universe is subject to change, with the single exception being the speed of light, and Einstein had made that discovery himself. People of wisdom are much more interested in questions than in answers. But foolish people are always coming back to conclusions. Like success, wisdom is a process, not a destination. Am I a wise person? I've been talking so much about wisdom, you must be wondering about my qualifications. I suppose everyone who manages to survive and even prosper to some extent has moments of self-satisfaction. Moments when you say to yourself, I finally got it all figured out once and for all. But usually, something comes along pretty quickly to humble you. I was sitting in an airplane on a flight from Texas to California, and looking out the window at the mountains and the desert far below, I was thinking to myself how, until quite recently, in the span of human history, nobody had ever seen anything like this. None of the kings and queens, none of the warriors, none of the wizards. Nobody had ever been able to fly 40,000 feet in the air and look down on the mountains. How powerful we've suddenly become. Today, all we have to do is buy an airline ticket, and we can do something that no one back then ever dreamed would be possible. For a moment or two, all this gave me a real feeling of power. It felt really good looking down on everything. But then I thought, wait a minute, can I stop the plane or turn it around? Can I take a walk outside and then come back to my seat? I can't even take a walk around the plane unless the little light tells me it's okay. I can't even feed myself in here. In all my adult life, I've never been less powerful than I am at this very moment. I'm completely helpless. It's that way with wisdom, too. When you think you really know something, stop for a second and see if the opposite isn't really true also. Do you think you're rich? Compared to whom? Maybe you're really poor. Do you think you're poor? Compared to whom? Maybe you're really rich. Picture a crowded subway car in New York City. Quite an experience, but not something I would recommend to the faint of heart. Hundreds of complete strangers jammed into a space designed for a third their number, all of them packed tighter than sardines in a little tiny can. Now suppose you're in that situation, and you've been on your feet all day, and you'd really like to sit down, but there are no seats left in the subway car, and you're standing there, hanging from that metal bar that hangs from the ceiling. Do you suppose you could come up with something that would convince somebody to give you their seat? That's a pretty good test of wisdom, in my opinion. You'd have to be pretty wise to come up with something like that in a crowded New York subway car. Frankly, I don't think King Solomon could have done it. I don't think Socrates could have done it. I don't even believe that Einstein could have done it. But then it happens. Somebody convinces not just one person, but several people to offer their seat. People are actually competing to give up their precious seats in that crowded New York subway car. Who is this somebody? A pregnant woman. A very pregnant woman, in fact. People are scrambling to give her their seats. But you see, it wasn't really the woman who convinced them to do it. It was the baby inside. It was a tiny creature who couldn't even talk or even imagine the very idea of talking, who convinced these tough New Yorkers to stand up. Einstein couldn't have done that. Excuse me, my name is Albert Einstein. Perhaps you've heard of me. Do you think I could have your seat here in the subway? Never heard of you, Einstein, but get lost anyway. But I'm very wise. Yeah, well, you're wising off to the wrong guy. So am I saying an unborn baby is wiser than Albert Einstein? Maybe you should decide. But that baby certainly solved the problem. Here's a phrase that I'm pretty sure contains some important wisdom. If you've reached the point in life where you feel you've got all the answers, you better start asking some different questions. The fool is always reaching his intellectual destination. The wise man is always wondering how much further there is to go. The fool's viewpoint is always narrowing. He talks more and more, but he listens less and less all the time. He starts saying the same things, and that's because he's always thinking the same thoughts. If he's a powerful fool, people are eager to help him along in this, particularly if they're dependent upon him for their living. but they're laughing at him behind his back. And they're watching and waiting, too, for the moment when he finally becomes a vulnerable. Here's a scene, a big league baseball game. The pitcher gets into an argument with the umpire. The pitcher has been covering first base on a bunt, but the ump calls the runner safe. So the pitcher just stands there with the ball in his hand, yelling and arguing, because he is sure he's right. He's sure the runner should be called out. But of course, the whole time he's arguing, the runner keeps running. And this pitcher is so sure he's right, he's so totally wrapped up in his own wisdom, that the runner runs all the way around the bases and scores. You've probably seen things like that happen. A person so convinced of their own wisdom that they cause more damage than any fool. It doesn't only happen on the baseball diamond. Stay away from people like that. And if you find yourself behaving like that, get a different baseball glove, because it's high time you stopped pitching and started catching for a while. My father once told me, I've seen a lot of wicked people and a lot of foolish ones, and I believe they both get what they deserve in the end. But the foolish ones get it first. I've found that to be true. In a way, it's the opposite of the idea that ignorance is bliss. Ignorance is not bliss, it's misery. It's poverty of the mind and spirit, and sooner or later of the bank account. Wisdom is wealth of the heart, mind, and soul. And unlike money, once you have it, no one and nothing can ever take it away from you. Once you've come to possess it, wisdom is yours forever. And even when you pass it on to others, your own store of it grows.